Namaste. We're getting close to the end of our chapter now. Yana Yoga lived entirely on the spiritualized mental plane. It is possible, and even usual, for these three fundamental aspects of the divine, the individual or immanent, the cosmic, and the transcendent, to stand out as separate realizations. Each by itself then appears sufficient to satisfy the yearning of the seeker. Alone with the personal divine in the inner heart's illumined secret chamber, he can build his being into the beloved's image and ascend out of fallen nature to dwell with him in some heaven of the spirit. Absolved in the cosmic wideness, released from ego, his personality reduced to a point of working of the universal force, himself calm, liberated, deathless in universality, motionless in the witness self, even while outspread without limit in unending space and time, he can enjoy in the world the freedom of the timeless. One pointed towards some ineffable transcendence, casting away his personality, shedding from him the labor and trouble of the universal dynamis, he can escape into an inexpressible nirvana, annul all things in an intolerant exaltation of flight into the incommunicable. Well, we know from our study in the Life Divine that these three terms of being come continually into play with Sri Aurobindo, the transcendent, the universal, and the individual. And spiritual liberation at any of these points is possible, whether as the awakened individual living in communion with the larger universe or shooting beyond both individuality and universe to reside simply in the blanked out, white, auspicious existence of that. But for Sri Aurobindo, he's driving to the point that none of this is, no one of them, no two of them, complete the challenge in front of us. This position, each by itself then, appears sufficient to satisfy the yearning of the seeker, alone with the personal divine in the inner heart's illumined secret chamber. He can build his being into the beloved's image. So this is the release of theism. Become one with that to whom you're attached. That's the whole meaning of bhakti, from the root bhaj, B-H-A-J, which means to attach yourself to. So yes, there are emotional overtones to it, obviously, the feeling that goes with it, but it is to be connected to feel communion with. But also to ascend out of fallen nature, to look at nature as if it is a deposit of ignorance, something from which we must escape. This is typical not only of theistic religions, Judaism, Islam, Christianity, but it's also true of much of the Vedantic tradition as we've received it. But all this so far about individual release. Absolved in the cosmic wideness, this is the individual being absolved in the cosmic wideness, released from the ego and personality. Sitting deathless in universality, but still as that shining point of liberation. Motionless in the witness self, Sakshi, we're back to Sankhya philosophy again, where the Purusha withdraws sanction from the cosmos, from the workings of nature, and lives eternized, but apart from all that moves and acts in the world. He can enjoy that deep solitude. But one pointed towards some ineffable transcendence, casting away his personality, he can escape into an inexpressible nirvana. Inexpressible because beyond the terms of the dualism natural to the mind, which divides, I am the subject, that is the object. How can the subject really know the object? Can the subject know what occurs in another subject, let alone what occurs in an object? All of this rather a wispy knowledge. But by escaping into the nothingness, into the blowing out of all existence, one has taken the flight away from the mutable into the immutable, away from that of which we cannot speak into that which shall not be spoken of, the incommunicable. This reminds one of Plotinus, or Plotinus if you prefer, and his adage, the flight of the alone to the alone. Many of these things here, you know, resonate with seeker after seeker, age after age. They're absolved in the cosmic wideness, released from ego, very much in tune with Taoism. The witness self, very much in tune with Sankhya. Enjoy in the world the freedom of the timeless, something that was pointed out as possible from the poetry of Wordsworth, where he imparts to the reader his experience of the oneness of nature, which later, of course, would be interpreted by Maurice Bucky, I think that's how they actually pronounce his name, not Buck, into his large volume on cosmic consciousness. We'll get to him in a minute. Back to Sri Aurobindo. But none of these achievements is enough for one who seeks the wide completeness of an integral yoga. Again, back to the word integral, from the word integer, to integrate, to make one, to make whole. So Sri Aurobindo will not divide among these aspects of being, a transcendence, a universality, an individuality. If there is only one being, then these are three poises of a single entity. There cannot be more than one. There can only be one. An individual salvation is not enough for him, for he finds himself opening to a cosmic consciousness, which far exceeds by its breadth and vastness the narrower intensity of a limited individual fulfillment, and its call is imperative. Driven by that immense compulsion, he must break through all separative boundaries, spread himself in world nature, contain the universe. Whitman. Do I contradict myself? Then I contradict myself. I contain multitudes. The term cosmic consciousness that Maurice Bucky originated is something that took time to grow in him. He was reading Whitman early on, and obviously Emerson. But it was his friend, Edward Carpenter, who had a deeper understanding of Oriental philosophy and shared that with him. And he used, Edward Carpenter used the phrase universal consciousness. Bucky, who had something of the poet in him, realized that the term cosmic consciousness had greater force, and the alliterative power of the term was what he preferred. And so he wrote that book based on an experience he had in 1872. He had been reading Whitman that evening and some of the romantic poets. And this is a reminder that art of all kinds can engender a yogic consciousness in one. Whether it is music, listening to Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, whether it's art, looking at the great works of Michelangelo or Leonardo da Vinci or Matisse, anything might serve to trigger a change of consciousness in you. A poem can do the same thing. And isn't that why you read Savitri? Because the poetry has a mantric power that affects a change in your consciousness, because it is within the body of the being of that poetry itself. Just as art radiates truth, just as music entrances you with its melodies, all of these things lift your consciousness back towards integration, reminds you of what you are ultimately, that you are one with all of this, that beauty that you're listening to exists in you. So, Bucky had this experience riding in a carriage in an evening where everything suddenly lit up in him. He thought there was a universal fire somewhere burning outside. It was in himself. He had an experience in which all the universe came alive to him. It was no longer a dead thing, this corporeal mass that life somehow manifested in, but the entirety of the universe was alive and was intended to be embraced, enjoyed, that we but needed the consciousness to do that. And so to grow out of small individuality and through the normal stages of humanity and into a transcending consciousness, well, a consciousness that merged you in oneness with the cosmos, more than the transcendence. That was his goal. And you might know that he was a psychiatrist later in his life. Had narrowly escaped death in a mining expedition in the late 50s. Lost a foot to frostbite. Managed to come back. Married. Did well in life. Had 8 children. And somehow came upon this magical, mystical experience in which much was revealed to him. So, we salute Maurice Bucky. But Sri Aurobindo continues, but, wait, above too, there is urgent upon him a dynamic realization pressing from the Supreme upon this world of beings. And only some encompassing and exceeding of the cosmic consciousness can release into manifestation here that yet unlavished splendor. Now mark the difference, because for Sri Aurobindo, who was endlessly engaged in sadhana, and not only began with the realization of nirvana, but then moved to embrace the universe as an expression of the personal divinity, something that was akin to this single unique experience that Bucky had, never to visit him again, Sri Aurobindo continues to grow and realizes that the reach of these powers of realization that he had achieved, liberation, moksha, dynamic oneness with the cosmic divine, will not change things here. It is utterly insufficient. But the cosmic consciousness too is not sufficient, for it is not all the divine reality, not integral. There is a divine secret behind personality that he must discover. There, waiting in it to be delivered here into time, stands the mystery of the embodiment of the transcendence. In the cosmic consciousness, there remains at the end a hiatus, an unequal equation of a highest knowledge that can liberate but not effectuate, with a power seeming to use a limited knowledge or masking itself with a surface ignorance that can create but creates imperfection, or a perfection transient, limited, and in fetters. This is something Sri Aurobindo affirmed in his actual practice. This is not theory to Sri Aurobindo. This is the body of his personal experience and the fruit of his yoga, which is why his sadhana never ended, despite realization after realization after realization. On one side, there is a free, undynamic witness, sakshi, purusha, and on the other side, a bound executrix of action, prakriti, who has not been given all the means of action. The reconciliation of these companions and opposites seems to be reserved, postponed, held back in an unmanifest still beyond us, there, beyond that transversal line that separates the transcendent from the cosmic. But again, a mere escape into some absolute transcendence leaves personality unfulfilled and the universal action inconclusive and cannot satisfy the integral seeker. So if you get on your yogic rocket ship and you launch yourself and you leave the cosmos and you shoot into the transcendence, well, there goes the possibility for this individual perfection in the universe. He's gone. He's useless to us now. He feels, the integral seeker, he feels that the truth that is forever is a power that creates as well as a stable existence. It is not a power solely of illusory or ignorant manifestation. The eternal truth can manifest its truths in time. It can create in knowledge and not only in inconscience and ignorance. And this gives the lie to Shankara, because Shankara's Maya has this manifestation housed in ignorance and a cunning deceit. So it can't create anything real. To Sri Aurobindo, the genius of Maya is that it creates the real out of the real. Purnam madaha, purnam idam. That is full. This is full. A divine descent, no less than an ascent to the divine, is possible. There is a prospect of the bringing down of a future perfection and a present deliverance. So the future and the present, the commingling, the trikala drishti of the supramental vision, all three times housed in ones. No division anymore, the transverse erased, and the descent of the timeless into time, of the transcendent into the cosmos, that there is no guard checking passports at the border any longer. There is free commerce between the two regions of real being. As his knowledge widens, it becomes for him more and more evident that it was this for which the Master of Works cast down the soul within him here as a spark of his fire into the darkness, that it might grow there into a center of the light that is forever. So here we have to linger because this is the Gita, isn't it? A Bhagavad Gita, chapter 7, the fifth shloka. Know my other nature. Different from this, the supreme para, which becomes the jiva, becomes the awakened individual, and by which this world is upheld. Huh. Goes on to the next verse, the sixth. Know this to be the womb of all beings. I am the birth of the whole world and its dissolution. So this being that transcendent person who is beyond time and yet present here, concealed behind what seems to be ignorant nature. Never gone, never left, always here. The same chapter in the Gita goes on. The tenth, know me to be the eternal seed of all existence. I am the intelligence of the intelligent, energy of the energetic. And then later in the chapter, the 24th, which gets to the puzzling of the mind a bit. Petty minds, think of me, the unmanifest, as being limited by manifestation. Purnam madaha, purnam idam. Because they don't know my supreme nature, para prakriti, my supreme nature of being, imperishable, most perfect. So the manifestation, the bringing forward of the infinity of possibilities inside the sheer being of the transcendent, as it becomes cosmic, does not mean a denial of its light, a dismissal of its joy. It is an invitation to discovery, to adventure, to wonderment. Then that goes on. The 25th shloka, nor am I revealed to all, enveloped in my yoga maya, using the measuring out through the power of yoga so that we have a story. We have a developing story that enacts itself epoch after epoch. This bewildered world knows me not. The unborn, the imperishable. So, taking birth, it is unborn. Measuring itself out, it is immeasurable. The mind can't think this. It can intuit it. The transcendent, the universal, the individual are three powers overarching, underlying, and penetrating the whole manifestation. This is the first of the Trinities. In the unfolding of consciousness also, these are the three fundamental terms, and none of them can be neglected if we would have the experience of the whole truth of existence. Out of the individual, we wake into a vaster, freer cosmic consciousness. But out of the universal, too, with its complex of forms and powers, we must emerge by a still greater self-exceeding into a consciousness without limits that is founded on the absolute. And yet, in this ascension, we do not really abolish, but take up and transfigure what we seem to leave. For there is a height where the three live eternally in each other, On that height, they are blissfully joined in a notice of their harmonized oneness. So first, he touches on sat. Then he touches on the nature of consciousness, and he closes touching on bliss, delight, sat chit ananda. But that summit is above the highest and largest spiritualized mentality, even if some reflection of it can be experienced there. Mind to attain to it, to live there, must exceed itself and be transformed into a supramental Gnostic light, power, and substance. In this lower diminished consciousness, a harmony can indeed be attempted, but it must always remain imperfect. A coordination is possible, not a simultaneous fused fulfillment. An ascent out of the mind is, for any greater realization, imperative. Or else there must be, with the ascent or consequent to it, a dynamic descent of the self-existent truth that exists always uplifted in its own light above mind, eternal, prior to the manifestation of life and matter. An ascent out of the mind. And recall the last chapters of The Life Divine, where all of this is part of his lengthy explication. So if we do not ascend, perhaps a dynamic descent . But how to know if the descent will work if the ascent has not been first attempted and secured? And this idea of the descent, as much as we refer to the Gita, is not part of its philosophy. It's not part of its vision. Krishna, in formulating this and in announcing a larger teaching that restores works to the order of the yoga, doesn't envision the transformation of nature upon earth. That is left for a different age. For mind is maya, sat, asat. This goes back to the Upanishad. This goes back to Vedanta. The Chandogya, the Brihadaranyaka don't agree, as you remember, about the nature of the universe and how it begins. And Advaita Vedanta doesn't satisfy the question of the cosmos and its answers, because we can't solve the riddle from the level of the mind. For mind is maya, sat asat. There is a field of embrace of the true and the false, the existent and the non-existent. And it is in that ambiguous field that mind seems to reign. But even in its own reign, it is in truth a diminished consciousness. It is not part of the original and supremely originating power of the eternal. This does take us back to the Gita, and this is the bewildered world that it was referring to. Even if mind is able to reflect some image of essential truth in its substance, yet the dynamic force and action of truth appears in it always broken and divided. All mind can do is to piece together the fragments or deduce a unity. Truth of mind is only a half-truth or a portion of a puzzle. Reflecting an image, so what the mind sees is a simulacrum. It isn't the real thing. Mental knowledge is always relative, partial, and inconclusive, and its outgoing action and creation come out still more confused in its steps, or precise only in narrow limits and by imperfect piecings together. Even in this diminished consciousness, the divine manifests as a spirit in mind, just as he moves as a spirit in life, or dwells still more obscurely as a spirit in matter. Mano Maya Purusha, Pranamaya Purusha, Annamaya Purusha. But not here is his full dynamic revelation. Not here the perfect identities of the eternal. Only when we cross the border into a larger luminous consciousness and self-aware substance, where divine truth is a native and not a stranger, will there be revealed to us the master of our existence in the imperishable integral truth of his being and his powers and his workings. Only there, too, will his works in us assume the flawless movement of his unfailing supramental purpose. So the nature of the Godhead is not revealable to mind. You cannot answer the question at the level of the mind, is there a God or is there not? But there, if you cross that threshold, there, not only is there knowledge, but vision and power reunite, or, to put it more truly, are always united. They are one and the same. This is a riddle that the Gita does suggest, but the yogin in his excellence is not able to bring that back into integration with the world. So the yoga installs you in a consciousness in which you're aware of the Supreme Divine, but you're not able to effectuate that consciousness in life. But to get the realization, even if you don't get the siddhi, is something. And the Gita is a great advance over earlier Vedanta. I think this is a place we can put a bookmark, and we'll finish the chapter next time. We only have a few pages left. So here's a section from Savitri in Book 1, The Book of Beginnings, and Canto 3, The Yoga of the Soul's Release. And we're starting on page 32. His center was no more an earthly mind. A power of seeing silence filled his limbs. Caught by a voiceless white epiphany into a vision that surpasses forms, into a living that surpasses life, he neared the still consciousness sustaining all. The voice that only by speech can move the mind became a silent knowledge in the soul. The strength that only in action feels its truth was lodged now in a mute, omnipotent peace. A leisure in the labor of the worlds, a pause in the joy and anguish of the search, restored the stress of nature to God's calm. A vast unanimity ended life's debate. The war of thoughts that fathers the universe, the clash of forces struggling to prevail in the tremendous shock that lights a star, as in the building of a grain of dust, the grooves that turn their dumb ellipse in space, plowed by the seeking of the world's desire, the long regurgitations of time's flood, the torment edging the dire force of lust that wakes kinetic in Earth's dullard slime and carves a personality out of mud, the sorrow by which nature's hunger is fed, the estrus which creates with fire of pain, the fate that punishes virtue with defeat, the tragedy that destroys long happiness, the weeping of love, the quarrel of the gods, seized in a truth which lives in its own light. His soul stood free, a witness and a king, absorbed no more in the moment-ridden flux, where mind incessantly drifts as on a raft, hurried from phenomenon to phenomenon. He abode at rest in indivisible time, as if a story long written but acted now. In his present he held his future and his past, felt in the seconds the uncounted years, and saw the hours like dots upon a page. An aspect of the unknown reality altered the meaning of the cosmic scene. This huge material universe became a small result of a stupendous force. Overtaking the moment, the eternal ray illumined that which never yet was made. Thought lay down in a mighty voicelessness. The toiling thinker widened and grew still. Wisdom transcendent touched his quivering heart. His soul could sail beyond thought's luminous bar. Mind screened no more the shoreless infinite. Across a void retreating sky he glimpsed, through a last glimmer and drift of vanishing stars, the superconscient realms of motionless peace, where judgment ceases and the word is mute, and the unconceived lies pathless and alone. There came not form or any mounting voice. There only were silence and the absolute. Out of that stillness, mind newborn arose and woke to truths once inexpressible, and forms appeared, dumbly significant, a seeing thought, a self-revealing voice. He knew the source from which his spirit came. Movement was married to the immobile vast. He plunged his roots into the infinite. He based his life upon eternity. Namaste, Jai Ma.